This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Reversals of policy create uncertainty. And so while I expect the industry to survive, and we may have opportunities in the next Congress or the next administration to put us on a better trajectory than we may look like in the next couple of years, some things won't come back.
Looking at energy policy under the current administration is a depressing exercise. The reconciliation bill of 2025, passed by the Republicans on July 4th, is a windfall for the oil and gas industry and devastating for renewables. Over 4.5 million homes with solar panels already installed, for example, are losing tax credits and other subsidies. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with Sean Gallagher, the Senior Vice President of Policy at the Solar Energy Industries Association, also known as SEIA, about the effects this newly signed legislation will have on the solar industry. Keeping in mind that our conversation with Gallagher preceded the bill's passing, we discuss the current state of solar and where it's headed and learn about the work of SEIA. Then we dig into the Sea Change Radio archives and hear an excerpt from our interview with Paul Bierman, a geoscientist at the University of Vermont, as he talks about Greenland's melting ice sheet. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Sean Gallagher. Sean is the Senior Vice President of Policy for the Solar Energy Industries Association, SEIA. Sean, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, and thanks for having us.
So the Solar Energy Industries Association, SEIA, what is the mission of your organization?
Sure, thanks for the question. SEIA is the National Trade Association for the Solar and Storage Industries in the United States. Our members are about 1,200 companies across the country in every state and in every sector of the solar industry. So everything from manufacturing of solar panels and other equipment that goes into a solar project to installers of rooftop projects, developers and construction companies that build large projects out on fields or in the desert, and everyone in between. And our mission is to foster the development of the industry.
So before the Trump administration came back into power, where were we in terms of subsidies and incentives for home solar usage? And where are things now as we sit on the precipice of this new Republican bill?
Sure. So solar energy has been booming over the past several years, driven in large part by incentives that were enacted by the Congress in 2022. In what's called the Inflation Reduction Act. Those incentives did a number of things, or that act did a number of things, including extend tax credits for installations of solar, whether it's on a customer's rooftop or a warehouse or in a field. It also, for the first time in many decades, established some industrial policy here in the US. Over the past decade and a half or so, the solar industry, which was born here in America, had been lost overseas, and the Inflation Reduction Act created incentives to bring that manufacturing back to the U.S. It's been very successful. Over the last 3 years, we've gone from 14th in the world in production of solar panels to 3rd in the world. We can now supply almost all of our annual demand for solar panels from American production, and we're making more components of solar products here in America. You asked where we stand now. The budget package that's moving through the Congress, it's also known as the reconciliation package or the Big Beautiful Bill, would make some pretty dramatic changes to the structure of the incentives, both for manufacturing of solar products and installation of those products. And our assessment is that would have pretty devastating effects on the deployment of solar, on investment in the U.S. over the next several years, and on jobs. It would wipe out factories, it would strand investments, It would raise customers' electric bills by as much as $51 billion. And maybe most important, although if those things aren't enough, it could cause a huge energy shortfall and even lead to power outages. We're in an era now, today, of really quickly increasing energy demand. For 20 plus years, we've been in an era of 1% annual electricity growth. Today, we're in an era of 6-ish percent annual electricity growth. That's driven by data centers, artificial intelligence, manufacturing, transportation electrification, and other factors. And all that electrification requires power. Solar energy is really the only form of new energy resource that's available at scale over the next several years. And if we don't foster as much deployment of solar as we can, we're going to really risk the ability to meet that growing energy demand.
And where are the greenest pastures for the lowest hanging fruit for accelerating the expansion of solar? Would it be in commercial buildings or in creating policies that mandate solar on new homes? Where do you see the greatest opportunity for expansion?
Well, it's really all the above. The incentives from the Inflation Reduction Act increase solar deployment across the board, whether it's rooftop solar for residential customers, rooftop solar for commercial customers, community solar projects, cell power to utilities, or the larger scale, utility scale solar projects. So I think that set of incentives, along with the manufacturing incentives, was, you know, it really gave a power boost to the industry and to our ability to meet clean energy goals. There has been a little bit of a slowdown in rooftop solar in particular, primarily as a result, the result of changes that California made to its compensation structure. So the industry in California has contracted pretty substantially over the last year and a half or so. But nationally, nationally, but for California, we see continued growth, and we see, you know, more and more states where solar, rooftop solar, is becoming affordable. So states that you might not expect to be leaders in rooftop solar include Texas, for example, and Florida, where there's not a ton of support of policy, but economics are good, and there's a need for it, among other things, for resilience purposes. Customers who are subject to hurricanes, for example, tend to go solar and add battery storage, so that if they have power outages, they can power their homes and sometimes their neighbors' homes.
Yes, we did a piece on Florida rooftop solar 5 or 6 years ago about how the Public Utility Commission in Florida had been not very warm to solar and prohibited the leasing of solar panels, which was one of the easiest ways to get home solar. It was much lower entry point for homeowners. Mystifyingly, that was not legal in Florida. You said that Florida is now a growing market. I remember it was like the 13th highest penetration level, even though it had like the second or third best sun profile of all the 50 states. What do you attribute the change there? Just the economics, irrespective of the leasing, or did they change the lease ban there?
The leasing issue remains. I think the economics are positive. And one thing that's changed over the last several years is the increasing availability of solar loan financing. So there's now a number of companies that sort of specialize in offering point of sale loan products to solar customers, so they can get in and, you know, with a low upfront cost, providing a similar opportunity to that from the leasing model.
Don't let the sun catch you crying, crying at my front door. You done daddy dirty, he sure don't want you no more. Don't let the sun catch you lying.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Sean Gallagher. He's the Senior Vice President of Policy for SEIA, the Solar Energy Industries Association. So, Sean, looking at the storage space within the solar industry, what technological breakthroughs are most promising? And I remember that being one of the talking points against solar 10 years ago is that, oh, well, what happens when the sun's not shining?
We've seen energy storage costs fall precipitously over the last several years, you know, a pattern kind of similar to what we'd seen in solar several years earlier. So energy storage is becoming increasingly affordable, and that's why we're seeing uptake rise from only a handful of percent for rooftop solar customers a couple of years ago to about a quarter, about 25% of rooftop solar customers now add storage or deploy storage along with their solar systems. We expect that to increase as the scale of battery manufacturing increases and as the costs continue to come down. We also see our utility scale developers adding storage to their projects because, again, they can respond to the grid operators' needs more effectively and provide power at the time it's needed most. So storage is actually a good story. And I'll just add that some of the manufacturing incentives that I mentioned earlier in the Inflation Reduction Act also apply to manufacturing of battery products here in the U.S., and we're seeing more and more of that coming along.
One of the thorniest issues from a policy standpoint on a state-by-state basis, Sean, has been net metering or solar buybacks. It's a very attractive concept for a home solar owner to be able to sell back some of their power to the utility, but it hasn't gone as smoothly as it might seem on paper. Why don't you explain the basic idea, people who aren't familiar with net metering, and then dive into where you and your colleagues can sometimes encounter hurdles in trying to roll out solar buyback systems in certain areas.
Sure. And I'll mention at the outset that our state policy team, which also reports up to me, is very active on net metering policy in about 15 states throughout the country. And so we're active in state legislatures and state regulatory commissions on a daily basis throughout the country. Net metering or net energy metering is the sort of traditional concept or approach to compensating solar customers for the power that they produce when their building is consuming less power than it's producing. So, for example, you put solar panels on your roof, it's a hot summer afternoon, and you're out at work or you're at the pool with family, you're not using much energy at home, your solar panels are collecting a lot of solar power, and that solar power flows back out onto the grid. Rather than being consumed in your home, it gets consumed in the homes of your neighbors. Under the sort of pure original approach to net energy metering, the energy meter on the outside of your house or building simply runs backwards when the building's producing more power than it's consuming, and the customer gets a credit for that power and basically pays only on the net amount of power that came into the building over the course of generally a month. The knock that utilities have put on net energy metering over the years is that it's basically crediting customers at the retail rate as opposed to the wholesale rate for power. And utilities have spent the last 12 or 14 years trying to modify net metering to reduce compensation to customers and reduce the attractiveness of going solar to those customers. I'd say that our view today is that net energy metering remains appropriate in a lot of markets here in the United States, particularly those which have lower penetration or lower retail rates. But we've seen big changes to net energy metering in places like California, where they've changed from a sort of an energy netting to a dollar netting or a cents per kilowatt netting. And rather than pay customers the full retail rate for the energy that their systems produce, they pay them something less. I think going forward, the real question is going to be, how do we develop a compensation system for solar customers that is both easy to understand for solar customers, appropriately values the solar energy, and gain some enough acceptance with utilities and the regulatory commissions that we can continue to deploy solar at scale. As I say, that's an issue that hasn't really been resolved, and that continues to be litigated and legislated in states around the country.
You spoke about wholesale versus retail pricing and net metering. Aren't there some states where net metering is just not on the table at all? And if that's the case, is it just the wholesale versus retail price that is at issue, or is there something deeper at play?
Yeah, there are a handful of states, maybe more than a handful now, where there's no form of net energy metering available. There's also a number of states where there's sort of modified forms of net energy metering that are available to customers. I'd say these issues arise for a couple of reasons. One, is that utilities in many states are vertically integrated. They are monopolies. They don't particularly like competition. Monopolies don't like competition. They don't like competition from their customers. Many utilities earn revenues on their energy sales, and so if customers are generating electricity, they don't earn those revenues, or they if they don't earn revenues on sales, they certainly earn revenues on investments. And if customers are making investments, that may decrease the opportunities for utilities to make investments. So there's opportunity cost to the utility. So basically, I think largely it's about competition, but there's also an element of trying to find the right price. In a high retail price state like California, where retail rates are 40 or 50 cents a kilowatt hour in the summer, probably isn't appropriate to give customers the full retail value when they put a kilowatt back on the grid. But it's also not appropriate to give them the simple average annual wholesale price that doesn't take into account time of day or time of year or other factors that affect the value of that kilowatt hour.
What were your projections before the Republican reconciliation package spelled out its plans for solar versus what you see now, Sean?
The key thing I think to recognize is that we're looking at projected installations of solar at around 40 gigawatts a year over the next 5 to 7 years. That's the equivalent of about 20 Hoover dams a year. But that is without taking into account the potential impacts of the reconciliation package. So reconciliation package throws all those projections into uncertainty. I can't give you numbers on exactly what the deployment will look like, but we can tell you that there'll be sort of enormous costs to the American economy and to the American consumer.
And how reversible would these policies be? Let's say 2028 or 2026, if Congress comes back into the Democrats' hands, how much can be turned around and how long could it take to reverse the damage that's being done to the industry?
Yeah, that's a fair question. I'm not sure one that I have a perfect answer to. Reversals of policy create uncertainty. And so while I expect the industry to survive, and we may have opportunities in the next Congress or the next administration to put us on a better trajectory than we may look like in the next couple of years, some things won't come back. Thinking in particular of factories that may be forced to shutter as a result of the changes that could occur in this tax package. Those are going to be hard to fix back up because investors are going to be concerned about the potential to lose future investment. So we'll continue advocating for the industry. I think the industry is going to survive and in the end thrive. Solar energy is the most dominant form of new energy resources, new electricity resources in America today. About 80% of all new electric resources put online last year were solar. About 70 to 80% of all new electric resources that are most advanced and most ready to be deployed are solar and energy storage. Customers like us, whether they're residential customers or tech companies or what have you. So the industry is going to survive. Ultimately, the industry is going to thrive. But these kinds of substantial policy flips do create lots of uncertainty in the meantime, and will create. Let's not sort of gloss over thousands of job losses, tens of thousands of job losses, hundreds of factories shut down, billions of extra dollars cost to consumers. Right? Energy supply increases will go down. Energy demand is go increases are going up. Basic laws of supply and demand mean customers are going to face higher prices.
He's the Senior Vice President for SEIA, the Solar Energy Industries Association's Sean Gallagher. Sean, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Paul Bierman. He is a professor of environmental sciences with a specialty in geoscience at the University of Vermont. Paul, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So your specialty is in Greenland, and it's very germane right now. You wrote a book called When the Ice is Gone, What a Greenland Ice Core Reveals About Earth's Tumultuous History and Perilous Future. This started well before the current president was fixated on Greenland. Why don't you give us a little bit of a history of the region in terms of the effects of climate change and what drew you to this area to study?
Absolutely. So I'm a geoscientist. I have always been interested in climate. I have always been interested in how people interact with the Earth. And so I was drawn to Greenland because of a love of snow and ice and glaciers, and took my first trip there in 2008. And it is a spectacular, almost mystical place. Most of it, you can fly over in a helicopter, an airplane, and you see nothing related to people. It's mostly wilderness area. And so during my trips there, I really got to appreciate the fact that the ice sheet was melting. I was there in 2012 when they had record floods coming off the melting ice sheet, and when the melt extended all the way to the top of the ice sheet 2 miles high, which is an extremely rare event, something that happens, oh, until recently on the order of once every 100 years, and now is happening far more frequently. So Greenland has a long history. You can take the rocks back billions of years, but I don't study rocks. I study ice and dirt and sediment. And if you want to think about climate in Greenland, the first people who really started thinking about that was a German expedition in 1930. By a guy named Alfred Wegener, who some of your listeners might remember is the father of plate tectonics and sort of fit the Earth's continents together like a jigsaw puzzle. He was actually a meteorologist by training, and his 1930 expedition put a camp on the East Coast, a camp on the West Coast. That's not unusual. A camp on the top of the ice sheet. That was extremely unusual. And three men spend the winter living inside the Greenland ice sheet, right at the summit. They dug a network of tunnels, and they lived in those tunnels and snow caves. Outside, it might have been minus 40 with 100-mile-an-hour wind, and inside their snow cave, it was 15 or 20 degrees Fahrenheit. They lived a lot in sleeping bags. They took weather observations. But they did something really intriguing. They dug a deep, deep trench with stairs in it, maybe from boredom, if you were sitting in the ice sheet for 6 months. And they figured out that the ice sheet was, in a lot of ways, like a rock. It had layers. And they could interpret those layers in terms of the past. And they dug down over 20 years worth of layers. And you say that's not much, and it isn't, because the ice sheet holds well over 100,000 years of layers in it. But it established the idea that we could understand climate by looking at the ice. Fast forward to World War II. Turns out that both the Americans and the Nazis really cared about Greenland, because if you're trying to forecast the weather in Europe and the battlefield, you need to know what it's like, where it's coming from. And since most of the weather moves west to east, the Nazis put camps on the east side of Greenland, and we put camps mostly on the west and the southern side. And it took a couple years before our Coast Guard found the Nazi weather camps and started the weather war, which really wasn't a war at all when it's soldiers versus meteorologists. But we started to care a lot about Greenland in World War II. And then when the Cold War came, we started to care even more, because we were worried about a Russian invasion over the top. And so the U.S. military, and this goes against the whole sort of red, blue, conservative, liberal climate piece, the U.S. military started thinking really hard about climate, because they needed to operate in a frozen theater And if Greenland was to warm up, their tracked vehicles wouldn't go anywhere, and they couldn't land airplanes on the ice.
So is there no land in the rest of the Arctic Circle above Greenland, like in the North Pole and very top of the planet? There is land, or is it just sea ice up there?
There are a few islands. It's mostly sea ice. There's a fantastic photograph of a U.S. nuclear submarine in the Arctic Ocean near the North Pole during the first crossing, popping up. So no, submarines crisscross the top of our globe all the time. There's no land there.
Now, you mentioned the tens of thousands of people who live on Greenland. Are they imperiled from melting ice sheets, or are the habitable areas not as prone to the permutations of melting ice?
They are in various ways. So I think that the most striking thing is that these are people who, for thousands of years, have had a lifestyle that depends on things frozen. Whether that's going across the ice in the winter with sled dogs, whether it's moving across the snow, whether it's their subsistence hunting and fishing. And so we're looking at a change of lifestyle that they didn't ask for that's happening in the Arctic. So the Arctic right now is warming at least two and perhaps as much as four times faster than the rest of the world. So they're seeing a change that way. There's certainly the potential for impacts within Greenland. And as I point out in that conversation piece that I wrote a couple of weeks ago, as the ice melts and the permafrost, the frozen ground melts, the number of rock slides and landslides are increasing. If those fall into a deep fjord, they generate a tsunami wave, which has inundated several towns in Greenland, that kind of thing. So there are hazards that come with melting, absolutely. And there's just the change of place from what you know. And I think that strikes all of us around the world, right? If in Vermont we're used to having snow, this is the first snowy winter I can remember in probably half a decade. Right? And it's pretty depressing when you sit in Burlington, Vermont, and a whole winter goes by and you see an inch of snow. 2 inches of snow. It's not what we're used to culturally. So I think that there's that piece. But again, I think people look at Greenland as this faraway place that doesn't matter to me, but it is going to matter to every one of us on the planet through sea level and through another phenomena, which it acts in a way like a giant reflector. So you have this massive white island covered with snow and ice, and it's reflecting the solar energy. As that ice sheet shrinks, you expose dark rock and you expose water. And eventually you have vegetation, and those soak up more of the sun's incoming solar radiation and they warm the planet. So if we lose Greenland, we have another feedback where the planet's simply going to get warmer. And I just want to stress, as I said earlier, and the military knew this, this was not a political issue. This is a survival issue for people around the world. Greenland doesn't care if we have a Republican government, a Democratic government, a socialist government, progressive government. The ice is going to melt depending on the temperature of the planet. That's it.
Paul Bierman from the University of Vermont, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by the New Master Sounds, Ray Charles, and Ziggy Marley.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.